Well, welcome everyone once again to the Horsing Around podcast. Of course, I'm your Broncos sideline reporter, Andy Lindahl. Our man, Andrew Mason, on the road. Going to probably be on the road a little bit more than he is used to this offseason as the Broncos get ready for a whole lot of scouting. Of course, after the Super Bowl, the Combine's first up now, or next up, I should say, in the NFL calendar as we get ready to start the player acquisition period. I guess before we start talking about Bronco matters, I've got to get your thoughts on that Super Bowl, Andrew. I don't, as much as we all hate to give New England their due, I don't know how you can't give them their due after now pulling off five trophies to put in the case.
Yeah, you've got to give them proper credit as, I would say, the greatest dynasty that we've seen in the league. And yes, Green Bay ran off five NFL championships and had a couple of Super Bowls at the end of that when the Super Bowl began back in the 1960s. And others, you know, the Steelers had their run. The 49ers had a great run. But to me, what makes the difference is accomplishing this in the free agency era, where the only two constants of this run were Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, and a constantly changing cast of characters around them, and yet they've continued to fire up one division title after another, one playoff season after another. This year was their 16th consecutive winning season. They've been in the postseason 14 times, five Super Bowl wins, seven Super Bowl appearances. Now, that being said, and while their accomplishments should be celebrated, I have to say that I look at Super Bowl 51 at least as much being about Atlanta falling apart and then New England capitalizing. Give the Patriots credit. When there was a door, they went through it and they seized it. But this is a result that could have been prevented by simply better game management from the Falcons than they offered. You know, better play calling relative to the situation. A lot of people are hung up on the 3rd and 1. When it was 28-12, but I go back to the 1st and 10 from the 22-yard line with just over 4 minutes to go. You need only a field goal to make it a 2-score game and set up a situation where New England would have had to had a touchdown, a 2-point conversion, an onside kick, and then a field goal to tie it. And after a 1-yard loss on first down, I felt like Atlanta got too cute, too bold in its play calling when you have a very accurate kicker from medium range in Matt Bryant. All you had to do was not have a big loss. There was no reason to roll the dice on a deep drop for Matt Ryan. I mean, if you're going to throw the ball, why not a play fake bootleg? We know this offensive scheme can do it. They didn't do that. And I'll also say that they were often snapping the ball with too much time on the play clock. Some snaps were coming with 13, 19 seconds left in the fourth game. During the fourth quarter, and 19 on the play clock, I should say, and they didn't manage the game like they were in front. They managed the game, and they were saying, "Oh, you be bold, you know, keep going." Sometimes discretion is the better part of valor. So credit to the Patriots, but the Falcons blew this one.
Yeah, they did, and it was unfortunate, I guess, to watch for those of us that would have liked to seen a different outcome. But the reality is, to your point, they are the greatest dynasty, I think, in NFL history. You and I talked on our talk show a little bit earlier in the week, and I've already said this to you, but look, I hate giving the Patriots this much credit, but the reality is this isn't a Chuck Knoll Steelers team that, and I'm not going to act like I know the roster backwards and forwards for those steel curtain defenses, but you were able to keep a core together. The Patriots have won five Super Bowls. They've gone to, what is it, 7 now?
Yeah.
And they've done it with a different cast almost every time. This is the free agency era where you didn't get a great team and then you just rode it while the rest of the NFL tried to put a great team together to stop you. People are constantly picking off your roster. And in some cases, the Patriots doing it to themselves. Jamie Collins, gone. On and on and on. We know how they get rid of good players. They're not afraid to move guys. They move the other linebacker whose name's escaped me right now to Cleveland. But they let them all go. It's been amazing to me how they have sustained this success. And I can't even tell you if Tom Brady's even had the same group of receivers for each of his Super Bowl runs. Andrew, it's just that's what's so amazing about this to me.
Yeah, I mean, you look at a good example. I mean, they had Wes Welker for quite a few years. I don't think Wes Welker was on a team of the Patriots that won at all, and he was a defining receiver for Tom Brady for several years. But I think he was on the teams that lost to the Giants in the Super Bowls. But Julian Edelman and Danny Amendola now. But then you go back to the early 2000s, and they were winning with Troy Brown and David Patton in Arena Football League refugee. They had Randy Moss for a spell. It'll be interesting. I think our friend Jeff Legwold will certainly address this when he's on the air with you. It's going to be a fascinating discussion when we start talking about representatives of these Patriots teams for the Hall of Fame, because you mentioned the Steelers, and they had a certain constancy with the teams they threw out there. So it was easy to say, Lynn Swann, John Stallworth, Mel Blount, Jack Lambert, Terry Bradshaw, they're Hall of Famers and they represent that team. Beyond Brady and Belichick, it will be interesting to see which players go into the Hall of Fame at least in part based on their accomplishments as Patriots, because there are no slam dunks. Now, Ty Law was one of the last 10 in the selection committee this year, so the door he may kick in the door at some point. But I've heard you've got Richard. I've heard Richard Seymour is a possibility. Vince Wilfork in a few years, but it will be interesting to see how this Patriots team because they're all different. How this Patriots dynasty is commemorated in Canton, Ohio, beyond the obvious Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, because there have been so few components that were connective tissue between the various eras of this dynasty.
See, and that's the perfect segue, because we were talking with Jeff Legwald earlier in the week, and I had asked him, now that our own Terrell Davis is finally in the Hall, a much well-deserved honor, especially when, what's so amazing about TD's career is we're talking about a guy that basically had, six, seven, maybe eight games of postseason play. He had the one game in Jacksonville the one year when they unfortunately got upset in 96. He had a three-game run when they were the wild card, and they went on to upset the Packers, having to play, what was that? So three, four games there with the Super Bowl, and then he had another three games. So I guess that would be eight games total for his postseason career before the devastating knee injury. And Terrell is still, in the top five, in the top 10, in a lot of postseason categories for rushing, touchdowns, all that kind of stuff. It is amazing when you look at Tom Brady. What Tom Brady's got, like 37 games of postseason play to have on his resume.
Another two whole seasons. Think about that in terms of how much he's played over his career. You take the fact that he's in his 17th season now, and you throw two seasons on top of that. Of course, he didn't really play as a rookie, and he missed one year because of torn ACL. But even you take those out, he's played 17 full seasons and shows no signs of slowing down.
Well, there's already word of maybe a three-year extension for the guy. It's just amazing. But my point being, with Terrell Davis going in now, and now you have four members of the 97-98 team, 97 with Gary Zimmerman, 97-98 for Sharp, Elway, Davis. Boy, that Broncos squad really does, because, I hope Steve Atwater gets stronger consideration. I hope maybe another defensive guy or two pops in there. Atwater's the strongest name in my mind. Maybe a Neil Smith somehow gets consideration, but he hasn't had a lot of momentum. So it's just my point being that 97-98 Broncos squad had to be one of the greatest of all time. Wouldn't you say, Andrew?
Well, yeah. The fact that it went back-to-back, that's what separates it from most Super Bowl winners. I mean, the Patriots have a back-to-back in there with 03 and 04. Broncos, the Cowboys in the early 1990s. The 49ers had a back-to-back in the late, in 88 and 89. The Steelers in the 70s with two back-to-backs. And Miami, and then Green Bay back in the 60s. Yeah, those are the teams that separate themselves from the pack of Super Bowl winners, the ones that did manage to do it again. And so I'm glad that Broncos era has gotten its due. I do want to see Steve Atwater get in. I think it would be worthy to have that defense represented. And even though the Orange Crush did not win a Super Bowl, got to one, was a defining defense of its era, it would be nice to see Randy Gradishar and or Louis Wright get some traction from the seniors committee. That's where, you know, I think John Lynch from the 2000s, I think he's going to get in. We're going to see Champ Bailey and Peyton Manning in the next few years. You hope to see Pat Bowlen, and there's every indication he's going to be the contributors subcommittee nominee for the 2018 class. But I would love to see somebody from the Orange Crush years be a nominee from the seniors subcommittee. And the seniors will have two nominees for the 2018 class, because it goes back and forth. Two contributors, one senior this year, two seniors, one contributor next year. That's an era I would like to see recognized, because you look at a lot of great defenses, of the 70s and 80s, Doomsday, Purple People Eaters in Minnesota, you know, Steel Curtain, and the Orange Crush, the no-name defense in Miami. And the Orange Crush in the late 70s and early 80s was right up there with them, and yet no recognition.
Yeah, I hope, like you said, a lot of these errors are corrected, but I'll tell you what, right now I'm going to sit on what is a very, I think for Bronco fans especially, very satisfying victory, in particular for Jeff Legwald. I want to tip my cap to him, the guy that had to argue the case for Terrell Davis. I'm not afraid to be honest about it, Andrew. I think Terrell Davis is deserving, because you and I both know how great he was, but I was really worried that the length of career was going to keep him out, and even TD worried that at the end of the day, the length of his career was not going to be enough to get him into the Hall of Fame. So I'll tell you, as much as we want to see some more people go in, it's a satisfying moment for Broncos country to see the guy that really, if anyone, it's amazing to me. Think about this. If I think about a face, one true face, if I had to pick one true face of those two teams, despite John getting his first one, to me, it's TD. And I think that's one of the reasons why he had to be in the Hall.
Yeah, he can't look at this. Look at Super Bowl 32. I mean, that, you know, everyone remembers this one's for John, but that was Terrell Davis's game. That was you know, he was the MVP, and clearly head and shoulders best player on the field. You can hear my my daughter chiming in here. She says there's a special delivery for me. Special delivery for Broncos fans was Terrell Davis getting in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. But,
I have a delivery.
Oh, well, may I have it, please? Thank you very much. It's a very colorful blanket that my daughter Charlotte has given me. But Terrell Davis. We're talking, you know, being the centerpiece of those teams. Yeah. You know, you say he's the face of the team. He's probably on the Broncos Mount Rushmore if you're making it. And the other thing with him getting in, I was happy for him, but I also felt a great sense of relief. We've seen how Broncos fans have reacted to the lack of Hall of Famers. As I went to the theater in downtown Houston on Saturday night to cover the event, I thought, my goodness, if this doesn't work out for the best, there are going to be an awful lot of angry people in Colorado. So when the word started getting out that Terrell Davis is in the Hall of Fame, sense of relief that he got in.
Yeah, and it's look, I'm with you. Sense of relief. And I'll be honest with you, Andrew, I don't know, other than to say if he doesn't get in, I don't know when he does get in. And I know some people thought, well, maybe next year will be okay. But Ray Lewis is coming down the pike.
He thought next year.
Well, I'm glad he thought next year. When I look at some of the guys that were coming up and Ray Lewis being an automatic, I just thought it was going to get harder and harder. I felt like he had such momentum going into this year. I don't know how you felt. I felt like if it didn't happen this year, we might be waiting a while again. Because, again, I felt like he had some good momentum going into this year. So I'm glad it wasn't wasted.
And here's the interesting thing. You know, and I don't know how it went in the room because I wasn't in there, but the seniors committee, the senior subcommittee nominee this year was Kenny Easley from Seattle, and he ended up getting in. Very deserving. Kenny Easley had a career that was the same length as Terrell Davis's, 7 seasons, cut short by a kidney ailment that forced him to retire. in 1988. And I wonder if the fact that he got in with a short career, I wonder if that helped TD, because all of a sudden, you know, the senior subcommittee had put forth a short career quality over quantity candidate like Kenny Easley. And the seniors committee subcommittee nominees almost always get in. So I wonder if that helped Terrell Davis. Like, okay, what's the real objection here? Because here's a guy that came out of the senior subcommittee that had the same length of career and actually didn't have the scope of accomplishments of Terrell Davis, because he never got to a Super Bowl. He didn't have a Super Bowl MVP, didn't have a league MVP, et cetera. And now I wonder if that's going to help other short career guys. Tony Boselli was a finalist this year. You know, he only had 7 seasons and was on injured reserve for his 8th year. I wonder if he's going to be the next guy that's able to take advantage of viewing quality over quantity. This may open up some doors for some guys who slip between the cracks. And I think, honestly, that's great. Even though it may not help any Broncos, I want to see more guys who hit the highest level for a short time get in the Hall of Fame.
Well, and I'll add to this. Look, if guys keep deciding that they maybe don't want to play 10-plus years anymore, and we've seen it with some of the linebackers in particular, this next generation of football player is more aware of what this game does to them when they leave it. And it's a great game, and we all love it. But I don't know that we're going to have so many 15-year careers anymore. I don't know, you know, that some guys may not even make it to 10 years. Some guys with the second contracts that some of these guys are getting, and think about Malik Jackson and the $90 million, that was a second contract. You get money like that, guys may not decide to, you know, unless they're like a Peyton Manning where they just can't live without it, there could be a lot of guys that have more of that 7-8-year career because they just don't want to put their bodies through it.
Well, interesting. Here's a case that may come up. I mean, what if J.J. Watt never gets back to full health?
Great point.
And ends up retiring in a year or two? I argue he's already done enough. You Broncos fans don't want to hear this. There's no indication that this would happen. But what if Von Miller said, 7 or 8 years is enough? I think Von Miller has done enough to make it to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I think J.J. Watt has done enough to make it to the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it is funny because Von Miller started talking about it being a Bronco for life, and I think some of us are curious, that could just be, the elation talking when he got that nice contract. It could also mean that maybe that's an insight, like you just pointed out. That could be a small peek that we're not realizing into what his thinking is for as long as he's going to play. We just don't know. We'll find out. That's all to be decided. I think, I agree. If you think about, we'll have to go maybe in a future podcast, talk a little bit about the guys that are currently on the Broncos roster that could possibly be Hall of Famers outside. I mean, obviously DeMarcus Ware is going to go, and he got his Super Bowl with the Broncos, so he'll always have an attachment to this team, and so will Von Miller. But outside of that, we could have an interesting discussion. Let's talk a little bit. And obviously we have a lot of time to cover before we get to Combine Day, so we can maybe go more extensively into this next week. But I'd be remiss if we didn't at least discuss your impressions of what the coordinators had to say to us, specifically Brock Oliva, who wanted to make sure he knew your name at the press conference yesterday, Andrew. He made sure he knew that he was talking to Andrew Mason. But he was a fun guy. But what did you take away? I mean, let's talk about the money positions. What did you take away from what we heard from Mike McCoy and Joe Woods?
Well, with Mike McCoy, it's the indication we got from Vance Joseph when he had his press conference to be introduced last month, and that it's going to be scheme. It's going to be players over scheme. So it's going to be the scheme being melded to fit what they do. So what's interesting is Mike McCoy said, look, the points of emphasis are probably going to change from week to week. It's going to be an offense that reacts and adapts to where the opponent is weak. So it's that kind of, frankly, it's a New England Patriot mindset. Find the weak spot and attack it. And maybe no two game plans look exactly the same. Now, McCoy, he never coached in New England, but he has influences from that. Of course, he came in to Denver back in 2009 with Josh McDaniels. The connective tissue is Jeff Davidson, who was on Bill Belichick's staff in New England, then went to Cleveland, then was the offensive coordinator in Carolina, worked with Mike McCoy. Davidson was the OC. McCoy was the passing game coordinator in 07 and 08, and now Davidson is the O-line coach with McCoy as the offensive coordinator. But the work with Davidson, and I think a little bit of the exposure of Josh McDaniels, really taught Mike McCoy about adapting each week to what the opponent to what the opponent gives you, and then reacting accordingly with your play calling. So I think it's going to be an offense that, frankly, is a little bit of a chameleon. And we saw some of that. We've seen some of that with the Chargers the last few years. Look at the game plan they had against the Broncos in the game in San Diego last October. They start the game, they're hitting the tight end. You know, they're hitting the tight ends hard, and that's something the Broncos have trouble with. They've had trouble defending tight ends over the years, and you see Antonio Gates makes some plays. You see Hunter Henry makes some plays. You even see the fullback Derek Watt get involved. And then the second half against a run defense that's shaky and playing with the lead, you see them hit go with Melvin Gordon. So that's the kind of that's the example of a Mike McCoy game plan that's going to try to hit a defense, even a very strong defense like Denver's, where it has a soft spot. And so I think we're going to see more of that. We're going to see, you know, maybe no two game plans are the same. Maybe even it's different from half to half. It's going to be a very varied offense. And also, I think up front on the offensive line, we're going to see some elements of zone blocking carry over because the assistant line coach is John Benton, who worked under Gary Kubiak in Houston. But then Jeff Davidson, well-versed in the power and gap schemes, there's going to be some of that as well. I think it's going to be an offense that maybe isn't classifiable, and that's what I get out that I got out of that, and that's a good thing. And then on defense, it's going to look very similar. They're going to maybe tweak some things, as Joe Woods said, but you know, they've got something that's working. They want to get stronger up front. You get the feeling that they're going to target defensive line in free agency, but there's not going to be a complete overhaul. So it's, you know, the parts of the defense that aren't broken, they're not going to try to fix. They're just going to say, okay, we're going to ride with that. You want to make sure you just rebuild the run defense a little bit. And if they can do that, they'll be right back where they were in 2015.
You know what I found so interesting, Andrew, is so many people, especially, you know, our reaction on the show is, oh, he talked about how it's going to be, you know, we're going to do what they do best and we're going to change it up to what they do best. And I think a lot of people know how verbose the West Coast offensive play calls were. That was one of the things that I think had Paxton Lynch thinking more than playing. And I think a lot of people think this new offense will be set up for Paxton Lynch to succeed. And I'd expect that too, but I want to warn Bronco fans, Paxton Lynch, it's not just about, you know, play calls, this and that. Certainly he had a whole different world he had to step into when he came into the Gary Kubiak playbook and tried to call some of his plays. But for me, Bronco fans, what they need to look for, what they need to look for us reporting when we get into camps is Paxton's got to be able to hit those mid-range routes on time, not late, with linebackers in zone coverage. It's the throws he's got to be able to make to get on the field. And some of that still is going to take some time. Again, from what I understand, his offense at Memphis was, you know. So I'm going to warn fans, I think they're going to give Paxton a better shot at getting on the field because he's not going to have to call these complicated play calls anymore. But I almost, look, he may win the job, but if he doesn't, let's back off the bus title that I'm already hearing people getting ready to label the kid. He's going to be 2 years in, and in his second offense in his career, he and Trevor, again, people need to learn to be patient with these quarterbacks in this town, because quarterback friendly doesn't mean that you still don't have to make certain throws that NFL teams expect.
Yeah, and even if the scheme is tweak to favor to play to Paxton Lynch's skill set, you know, let's say you're doing a lot more shotgun, a lot with some spread type principles that Paxton Lynch has worked with at Memphis. Well, Trevor Siemian did some of that at Northwestern. He did a lot. He worked a lot in the shotgun, and he's young. What's to say that he can't improve? Yeah, you know, there's upside with him too. It's entirely possible that you could have a scheme that is clearly tilted toward Paxton Lynch's skill set, but that Trevor Siemian, with the natural improvement from year one of playing as a pro to year two, that he ends up getting the job outright. I mean, this is, you know, I think a lot of people are out that are observing this from afar are thinking, you know, Paxton Lynch is going to be handed the job and he's going to win. I really don't think that's the case. And if Trevor Siemian goes in there and has a decent amount of improvement from last year, there's no reason why he not only can't win the job, but do reasonably well in whatever scheme that Mike McCoy ends up cooking up.
Yeah, I agree. The bottom line is I just think Bronco fans need to find a way to have a little patience because no matter what happens this year, I guess what I'm trying to remind Bronco fans of, A, I think if you've heard this, and Andrew, you know this, I am, to what you've said, I'm a fan of Trevor Siemian. I believe in what the kid can do. I think his release is more special than people realize. I think that's something that makes him unique, and he's accurate, and he's smart, and you've got a good foundation laid for him after last year. And I also, I just feel like kind of what you said, I feel like the national take is already, well, this is going to be slanted so Paxton wins the job. And if he doesn't, I can already hear the headline, hear the radio talk and see the headlines and how this is going to go down. I want to just remind everybody, it was said that when Paxton Lynch was drafted, that it would be next year that you would expect him to really jump in and compete. And if that's how it plays out, then that's how it plays out. I just think because of what Dak Prescott did, all of a sudden, everybody threw out the timelines for a majority of these quarterbacks that were rookies last year. So you get that offensive line fixed, and Mike McCoy said that yesterday. If you fix the offensive line, that's the most quarterback-friendly offense you can have, and that's where I think the Broncos have to start.
And he even said, this offense goes as far as the offensive line takes it. And I think we'll see what moves are in store, but it's pretty clear that's the priority that – it's, you know, get that unit of the offense up to speed. You know, McCoy's work with Demaryius Thomas, he knows, was around when Demaryius kind of flipped that switch in his second year during the Tim Tebow starts. Demaryius started hitting the elite level when Tebow was here. What he wasn't a product of Peyton Manning. That the last several games of the 2011 season, Demaryius Thomas arrived. He wasn't a creation of Peyton Manning. So McCoy knows what Demaryius can do. He's going to find out how Emmanuel Sanders can help. It'll be interesting to see what kind of role they have for Sanders as well, because it wouldn't surprise me if they see Sanders working more in the slot from time to time. Maybe he becomes the offensive version of Chris Harris Jr., working outside in the base offense, and then when you go three wide, moving into the slot. That's something that we haven't really seen much of from Sanders, but maybe that's a direction that Mike McCoy chooses to go in. It'll be fascinating to see how they use Sanders, because he does have some skills that I think would lend themselves to being used in the slot and performing very well in the slot when the Broncos go three wide.
I'm going to leave you with this thought. And by the time folks hear this podcast, we may already have a decision. There's no indication of what's going on yet, but we can talk more about it if it does happen. But there is some chatter out of Jacksonville, as you and I talked about on the show earlier this week, that maybe Julius Thomas is let go. I know Martellus Bennett is at the top of everyone's tight end free agent list, but there's rumors of Packers, or at least, and rumors as far as Pro Football Talk goes and some of the tweets that I've seen, that they may franchise Martellus Bennett, especially with the unknown future of Rob Gronkowski and the back injury and so on and so forth. So
And all the cap room they have, they could afford to franchise Martellus Bennett.
So with that happening, if Julius Thomas becomes available because the Jaguars decide not to guarantee any of that salary, do you think the Broncos kick the tires on a return, or do you think the ending was so bitter that they don't bother to pay a visit?
Well, I think the ending is what you'd have to work past. You have to, work through some hurt feelings, I think, on both sides that went down. But at the same time, Mike McCoy, he was around when Julius Thomas was drafted. Now, Julius didn't really have his breakthrough until McCoy went on to San Diego. But, McCoy is well aware of what Thomas's skill set is and what his capabilities are. It's just that he was dealing with the ankle problems while McCoy was the offensive coordinator. So he's familiar with him. That may help if they decide to take a look at Julius Thomas. Now, that being said, if you did make a move for Julius Thomas, I would, in terms of short and long-term planning, I would say bring him in, but in terms of being a receiving target, maybe, to use the fantasy thing, maybe you handcuff him with a rookie, because of course this draft class we've talked about, it's sensational tight end. If you're going to get a tight end, this is the year, and there's going to be talent down well into day two and day three, there's going to be some quality tight ends available in the third round that maybe even slip to the fourth round. So if you could get one of those guys, you know, late on day two, the Broncos could have a couple of extra picks, compensatory wise, to round out the third round. If you could have a young guy to go along with a Julius Thomas, I think he'd have something he could work with for the long term. Virgil Green, he's in the last year of his contract. Jury's still out on Jeff Hireman. Jury's still out on AJ Derby. But if you want, it would be possible if you wanted to just go and get younger that you could have a rookie tight end with Julius Thomas, and that might be your long-term insurance policy if you brought in Julius Thomas, but the injury issues persisted.
He, of course, is DenverBroncos.com, Andrew Mason. I call him the Oracle, Little Ditka, depending on what his outfit looks like. I'm Andy Lindahl, your Broncos sideline reporter. We'll have more on the Horse and Round podcast ahead.